Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking to Cedric Dahl, an early Bitcoin adopter who is going to talk to us about national governments, the dark net, and what those might mean for the future of Bitcoin. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news.
All right, welcome to this special episode of the FinTech Newscast. We have a guest with us this week, Cedric Dahl, who's been working with blockchain and Bitcoin for 10 years now, I guess it is. It seems like we would all have really long gray hair with all the ups and downs and stresses of blockchain in the past few years. With me this week is our co-host, Steve.
Hey, John, good to be here.
Yeah, glad you're here. And Cedric, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in Bitcoin in the first place?
Sure. So I think my story is pretty typical. A really smart friend tried to convince me that Bitcoin was great, and I thought it was the silliest thing I'd ever heard of. And I ignored my friend. And thankfully, that smart friend kept nudging me for a while, more than a year, before I finally had my aha moment. And that aha moment was when my friend, Bennett, who was so early, you know, I think he read the first version of the white paper in maybe late 2009, before the network was really anything, maybe even before it was live. And I think it was finally late 2010, early 2011-ish. I don't remember the dates exactly. One day he sat me and he's like, Cedric, remember that Bitcoin thing? Now people are buying drugs with it. And I was like, what? That doesn't make any sense. The government's just going to shut them down. And
that scared me away at the beginning, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason that really was my aha moment is I am the survivor of grandparents who went through the Holocaust. So, you know, I was raised with these stories of, hey, you know, at any moment, everything that you have, your savings, your house, everything could be taken. And so, you know, after growing up with those stories, you're always on the lookout for, okay, how do I safeguard any wealth that I'm lucky enough to put together? And so when I started to go down the rabbit hole on Bitcoin, I realized, oh, this thing is censorship resistant. It's unstoppable. Basically, every participant in the network has the exact same power. And that's new. Like, imagine if that was around during the Holocaust. My grandparents would have had a very different experience. And so that's what got me to start paying attention. And then there was just a series of right time, right place, again and again and again. You know, we ended up basically helping Silicon Valley buy their first Bitcoins. You know, at first it was angel investors and, you know, tech founders, and eventually it was venture capitalists. And one of those VCs was like, hey, you should help people do this at scale. And, you know, why don't you take my money? And we're like, what? You want to give us money? Okay, we'll take your money. And, sure. You know, we really knew very little about what we were doing or committing to, but we ended up going down this rabbit hole where we very luckily raised money from Google Ventures, Y Combinator, one of the guys who started Reddit. And we really, like, in doing this, we had to become technology historians. And so we went from being, like, you know, really, truly just regular people who were trying to figure it out to having to go down the rabbit hole pretty aggressively on how normal money works and how internet money works. And they're very different. But, like, for the last 10-ish years, I've been, like, aggressively, obsessively going down these rabbit holes. And I've come to a pretty weird conclusion. And I'll kind of fast forward to the end, which is, I think we might be at the beginning of the end of crypto, which is like a weird thing to say, and I'm happy to unpackage that. But I think it's safe to say at this point that the cat's out of the bag, and I don't think there's any going back to the world before crypto.
So when you say the beginning of the end, it seems like if you look at the history of both sort of the price and the adoption of, you know, DLT as well as crypto, it's sort of taken shape in stops and starts, right? We see companies like IBM and even Goldman Sachs getting into this space, but also the price truly fluctuating very wildly, although it's had a really good 6 months or so. What do you mean by the beginning of the end? Is this sort of the end of crypto as you know it, sort of a new stage in crypto, or how do you define the new beginning?
Yeah, so first I would encourage you, and feel free to disagree with me, but I'd encourage you to not look at the price at all, and in fact, to not even consider it. What I would look for instead are like so what you described is a speculator network effect, right? All these speculators come in and they're gambling, betting on the price. Now, after speculators come developers. They're like, oh, there's a bunch of money here. Maybe I can build some tools and make a killer app that people use, right? And maybe I can scoop up some of these coins on the way. And if they go up in value, hurrah, I've done better financially. But really the most important network effect of all, and the hardest one to win, but really the only important one, if you really want to find like a really underappreciated piece of technology that can really grow in value, is you're looking for a growth rate of adoption, right? This is borrowing from Paul Graham, the guy who started Y Combinator. But really you're looking for a technology that is solving a hair on fire problem for a market that is extremely valuable and extremely underserved. And it's my opinion that every single person in crypto, with almost no exceptions, is having the complete wrong conversation when they're thinking about crypto adoption. So I'm going to propose something that at first is going to sound pretty crazy, but I'm saying this because I would like to invite you to disagree with me. And that's kind of the point of this podcast tour that I'm on at the moment, is I need people to disagree with me, because what I'm about to share with you, I've been sharing with everyone who will listen, and I'm not finding enough disagreement. And so—
All right, I'm ready to disagree. Lay it on me.
Awesome. Okay. So if you think about the normal crypto conversation, it goes like this. When is it going to get mainstream adoption? And then you've got all sorts of answers, most of which are just stories, right? The stories.
And the meaning of that is like different things. Like, you know, do you mean blockchain? Do you mean specific coin? Like Steve mentioned IBM, but that's like a blockchain technology, not necessarily crypto, crypto coins or anything.
Right.
It's like there's it's a lot of different use cases, or digital identity on blockchain.
Smart contracts, the whole thing, right?
So,
yes.
So, so you mean, or Ripple, where the coin maybe is not that great, but maybe that, and they always argue that technology, the blockchain, the Ripple net is a totally separate thing, and there's that use case. So, so I guess I would define the terms a little bit.
So the short answer is yes to all of the above. You can call it whatever you want. It really,
okay. So you
it
mean
doesn't
everything.
Matter.
Okay.
Yeah. So all of, well, we'll get to that in a second. I will give you an idea and you can use it, and it will like sort of self-filter any coin you want to put through it. So I'm not here to advocate for any coin in particular. What I am going to propose instead is that applied cryptography has one and only one use case. So when you say crypto, I'm just going to say anything that fits this definition. It cannot be censored. It cannot be stopped. And every participant in the network has the same power. So run whatever you want through that filter, and whatever's left over, let's call that crypto. So what I'm saying is that if you study the history of technology investing, what you will find is that you have to look for the big winners, you have to look at the user network effects. You have to ignore the speculator network effects. They will mislead you, and they're a lagging indicator. The developer network effect is interesting, but it's not really where you get a killer app from. You know, the killer app is decided by the users. And so the question is, where is crypto, as we've defined it, useful? Where can it do something that no other technology can do, where it is solving a giant hair-on-fire problem? And the truth is that crypto has very few use cases. There are very few things that need censorship resistance. But there is one area where it is crystal clear that you need censorship resistance, and that is the black market. Now, how do you study the black market? Well, it's really friggin' hard, but there has been this development since the invention of this technology called Tor. And that invention, along with, you know, in the 90s, the US government and others deciding to make PGP and other applied cryptography legal because they weren't sure if they were going to do it. But the combination of these two things made the dark net possible. And the dark net is the piece of the internet that is eating the black market. So if you study this little tiny slice of the internet, and it is a tiny slice, what you realize pretty quickly is you can actually get a sense of which cryptos are being adopted. And what I found there about 2 years ago shocked me, and it got me obsessed with going down the rabbit hole. And if you're up for it, I would like to lay out my findings and take you down the path I've gone to this very odd conclusion that we are at the beginning of the end of crypto. And what I mean by that is I think we are seeing enough signals that we can start to have a conversation about governments taking some portion of the reserves and putting them into crypto. And specifically, that the darknet is a leading indicator of not only government adoption of crypto, but also of which specific crypto is being adopted asymmetrically. In technology, you have this thing called a long tail distribution, where the head of the long tail, the first place thing, whatever it is, accounts for a giant percentage of use. Second place is a distant second, and the tail tapers off. I know that's a lot, but if you're up for it, that's the conversation I propose that we have.
So this makes sense, but a couple of questions here. By governments, do you mean sort of the traditional OECD democracies, or the more sort of rogue states, the North Koreas and Venezuelas and Argentinas of the world?
Great question. The short answer is yes, all of them. And so there's a fantastic book, which I love, called The Dictator's Handbook. And the way that they define government, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, forgive me if the author is listening and I butcher this, but the idea of how they describe government is a group that reallocates treasure by force and generally has the monopoly on force. So let's just use that as a placeholder definition. You know, we can switch it around if we want. But if you use that as a definition, what you're really talking about are the men with guns and the men with malware. These are the people who have asymmetric power. So the question is, if these are, whether you want to call them governments or, you know, nation state actors, these are the people who are shaping the experience that the vast majority of the rest of us have. And they are just more powerful than us. We have to do what they say. We just have to. It's just the way it is, right? And so the question is, are these people on the dark net? We know definitively the short answer is yes. Now the question is, are they proactively hoarding a crypto? We think so. I'll get to that in a second. And then if they are, and you lay out the game theory, because there's actually like quite a small group of countries or nation state actors that have a meaningful amount of power, which is really odd, because if you break apart the actual users of crypto, you have retail, you have professional investors, and you have these nation state actors or governments. Now, it's very odd because the retail section is a giant number of people, and it's where most of the story and conversation focuses. Then you have this dramatically smaller group of people, professional investors, hedge funds, prop shops, family offices, multifamily offices. And the funny thing about them is, even though they are like a much smaller group, on average, like the professional investor in this group in crypto tends to be deploying dramatically more capital. You know, like the group size is orders of magnitude smaller, and generally the check size is orders of magnitude larger. And then you go to this final market of nation state actors, governments, and it is the smallest group. Again, orders of magnitude smaller, but when you're talking about the wealth that they control, it's all the money in the world. And so what I propose is that everyone is talking about this retail market, which is irrelevant. It does not matter if retail adopts crypto. Instead, I would encourage everyone to think about this very small number of people who control government, and understanding that if they take some percentage of their reserve and they are putting it into crypto, then that is the only thing that needs to happen in order for the value of the head of the long tail distribution of crypto adoption to explode many, many times in value. And when I say times, I mean thousands, plural, thousands of multiples above where any crypto price currently is. So that is my very high level thesis, and I'd love to break it apart for you.
Actually, yeah, I'd love to dig in on that latter part there. So your thesis basically is that a lot of nation states, right, people with guns or, you know, what a policy major would call an entity with a monopoly on violence is looking to hoard specific cryptocurrencies. And that's where we think the bigger opportunity will be. Instead of the retail or the professional investor class, it'll be these nation states.
Yes, and I would go further to argue that the smart money in that professional investor space, that is what they are betting on consciously. They may not talk about this. It may not be a popular conversation. It may be taboo to talk about the darknet. It may be taboo until we reach some inflection point to propose that this is going to happen. But I believe that we are somewhere on that path towards that inflection point. And it would be irresponsible of us, of governments, to not be having this conversation. Because I think that, well, it's not just I think, the game theory works out like this. If we hit that inflection point, right? Well, let me back up for a second. The game theory works like this. The most sanctioned countries, the most disadvantaged countries, have the largest incentive to proactively hoard the dominant crypto on the darknet.
Why?
Because if you are using the darknet, you can influence nation state events quite easily. So for example, election season last time in the US, what happened? Cambridge Analytica, Facebook. Is that going to happen again in a, like a light economy service? Very unlikely. Is it going to happen in a darknet forum where black market engineers and participants are able to do this? Well, it's on offer right now. You can find this on offer. You can pay for this in the darknet. And there are various vendors of various reputation that are willing to sell you this service. And so it appears, based off of what we're seeing with services like Dark Owl, what different journalists are reporting, we don't have like direct lines and direct evidence, but we are looking for it proactively. But we are seeing lots of reports from credible people and organizations saying this is happening, and we are chasing those leads. And so if this is the case, if it is the case that people who want to affect nation state level events are using the darknet increasingly to do it, and by the way, that's what we've seen in 2019, that seems to be going up pretty dramatically, then what it means is whoever is the most disadvantaged or sanctioned country has an incentive to proactively hoard that crypto so that they can continue to deploy capital on the darknet, regardless if that underlying crypto is going up in value. Now think about this, right? If you're North
because
Korea,
it's medium of exchange on the darknet, so the transaction is that cryptocurrency is the common one or whatever it is for buying likes on Facebook, or specifically what is it that you're getting?
It depends. I mean, you'd be amazed at how big the darknet
that, I mean, that as a government.
Well, so there is malware for sale. There are malware brokers who basically buy it from engineers and then broker it to who they claim to be nation state actors. So there are intelligence agencies who are publicly advertising for engineers who can help them scrape the darknet. You are seeing intelligence officers basically being doxxed on the darknet, where they're being called out, and then proof is being given that the person who's, you know, being interacted with is actually a government official. So there is an increasing number of signals that we are getting that nation state actors are for sure participating on the darknet. Now, what I'm saying is the signals are there, but we need to connect the dots. We need to like say this for sure is happening with this country, and further, we need to figure out which crypto they specifically are using. Now we have some signals about which cryptos are dominant on the darknet more broadly, but we're still digging down the rabbit hole to get specifics. So I don't mean to mislead you at all that, you know, we can say that North Korea or some other sanctioned country is using this. What I can say is here's what we found so far. Here's what that leads us to believe. And this is the conversation I think we should be having.
This is the cryptocurrency that's being used on the dark web, how does that translate into wider usage for a very specific kind of case? And then, you know, Bitcoin has been used for the Silk Road and all this as the currency of choice, and maybe it's something else at different times. How does that translate into like a broader usage, or like you're saying, like an investment case or something where it scales beyond or escapes out of the dark web?
Yeah, so the short answer is it doesn't matter. And I know that sounds weird, but I'll get to that in just 1 second. So we talked about the reason that the most sanctioned countries would want to use this. In short, you know, to put it in medieval terms, the roads, the financial roads to their castles have been cut off. They've been sanctioned.
Yeah, for sure.
The ports to their cities have been blocked.
80% of the trade is US dollars, so if you get cut off, yeah.
Yeah, Iran, sure, absolutely.
So I think that this part is very easy to agree with. Let me know what your thoughts are on this next part. So the next part, the way the game theory works out is this. So there's a very small number of countries, right? And you've got some sanctioned countries. Well, you know, in order to trade, we're already seeing announcements like in September of 2019, where you've had public announcements where countries are saying, we are setting up crypto infrastructure. You've also had leaked announcements where governments are saying, we are setting up crypto infrastructure. So we know for sure that the intention is there for sanctioned countries to set up crypto infrastructure. And the reason to do that is to trade. Trade is a hair on fire problem. And if you don't have access to the world's money, you've got a real problem.
That's sanctioned by the US. So like the Chinese digital currency might be fine for Pakistan and Iran to use.
So maybe they can trade
as long as it's not US dollars.
We should come back to that. So I just want to finish up the game theory, if that's all right. We understand the most sanctioned countries, but what about the most advantaged, least sanctioned countries? They actually have a relatively large disadvantage initially. They have a disincentive initially. They do not want to give up their power asymmetry, right? But there comes this inflection point that if, and I'm not saying it's happening yet, but if it is clear that progressively more and more countries are putting some amount of their reserve into a black net, a dark net crypto, if that is happening, then what's happening is with every new participant in that network, the value of that head of the long tail of crypto that's being adopted is going up. And the last country to adopt that crypto is the worst off. So nobody wants to be the last to adopt whatever that dominant crypto ends up being. There is a huge disadvantage in being last. So what that means is that there is some inflection point, I don't think we're there yet, where major non-disadvantaged countries who currently have power asymmetries recognize that all of these people who are really disadvantaged are starting to adopt a thing. And if it continues, the price will rise and they will have to pay more for it. And so from that inflection point onward, you would expect a very fast acceleration of adoption. And what I'm saying is we are somewhere at the very beginning of that happening based on what we're seeing on the darknet.
So you run a research shop. What sort of evidence do you have of these countries hoarding cryptocurrencies in the darknet in terms of either Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, or Denmark, right?
Yeah, we don't. We don't have specifics. Here's what I can tell you. The research that we're seeing is coming from places like this. So there's a, you know, just like Google downloads the internet and makes it searchable for you, there are services like this one called Dark Owl that download the darknet and make it searchable. And they're putting out reports. I think we may have shared one with you. I can reshare it with you if it's helpful after this conversation. But they are sharing reports basically giving very specific examples of, okay, so here's what we're seeing. Here's how different nation states or nation state actors, not necessarily an elected government, but here's how people are using the darknet to attempt to alter the course of an election, for example. And so happy to share those details more specifically. You're also seeing some pretty weird connections between the dominant crypto on the darknet. If it makes sense, I'm happy to tell you what we found there, as well as the tools that are used to make it private, because it's not a privacy coin, which is really surprising, right? Like when I started this 2 years ago, I was expecting to see a privacy coin being dominant on the darknet, and it's not the case at all. And so there is a specific technology that is used to make the dominant crypto private, and it's quite good. And so the thing about this technology, it's called CoinJoin. And it's not a mixer. So people inaccurately call it a mixer. So a mixer is you just throw your money in and you get back some coins, but it's extremely easy to trace. This thing is like a mixer on steroids. The way it works is the more participants who join, the harder it is to trace where the transactions came from and to. It basically like makes the history of your crypto invisible. It's impossible to track where these things have been. And so it makes all coins fungible.
With Bitcoin, you can trace everything back, right? There's services that can do that, right?
Well, you know, there are services that will claim that. So it probably makes sense for me to call out what we found in terms of dominant crypto. So 2 years ago, we did this experiment expecting to get some signals about which privacy coins were dominant. And what we found was it was actually Bitcoin that was dominant on the darknet. The way we do that is we hire Mechanical Turks. These are humans that we give instructions to. We say, go to the darknet, log on to all of the different darknets that are active, and just count every single vendor, what coins do they accept? And by a landslide, it was about 70% Bitcoin. And then you had four altcoins at the time. I think it was Monero, Litecoin, Ethereum, and just Bitcoin. So it was actually just four coins total at the time. And there haven't been too many changes. Except for this, you've had giant amounts of shutdowns on the darknet. So these darknet markets, for the most part, the owners shut them down. Either they voluntarily shut them down peacefully or exit scams happen. Police shutting down darknet markets is actually very uncommon. It's the least common way that they end up shutting down. And so what's happening is there's chaos on the darknet, but there's one consistent thing, which is that Bitcoin is not only remaining dominant on the darknet, but it's growing its dominance. So today, out of, I think, 14 different active darknet markets that we track, I think one just got shut down a few days ago, actually. So it might be 13 or 14 at the moment that we're tracking. So it's 9 out of 14 are Bitcoin only. One is a privacy only one. Monopoly market is Monero only. And then the remaining ones are, you know, Bitcoin and altcoins, with Bitcoin being super dominant, the head of the long tail and a long tail distribution. And so this really surprised me, because I thought what you just said, I thought Bitcoin's not private. These people are dumb. Why are they accepting Bitcoin? And that got me to start asking other researchers. I hit up this guy, Juan, who runs Verify Research. It's a Bitcoin privacy research firm. And I'm like, well, how is this happening? And what he helped me understand is this CoinJoin technology. And the thing about CoinJoin is that, just like all technologies, it benefits from what's called a network effect. So the more users using a specific implementation of CoinJoin, the better it gets. And it becomes very hard for a different CoinJoin implementation to compete. And so the one that just got adopted first was this thing called Wasabi. And the cool thing about Wasabi, unfortunately this has recently changed a few days ago, is that they used this thing called a coordinator address. One coordinator address for several months. This is how they got paid. And what this allowed us to do is we could reverse engineer every single coin join that they did. We couldn't track like where those coins were coming from or to, but we could count the amount of Bitcoins flowing through this coin join. And a really weird thing, first of all, their growth is insane. It's like exploding. It's like early Facebook level growth. I mean, if you're a technology investor, wow, you really want to try to get some money into Wasabi Wallet, as long as it's, you know, legal in your jurisdiction. But here's the really crazy part for me.
Is it legal in the U.S. jurisdiction?
I have no idea. They say it's legal in Malta.
This is not legal advice here.
Yeah. Hey, listen, honestly, respect the men with guns and the men with malware. Like, don't break any laws. I would also discourage you from going on the darknet, because on the darknet, you're on the menu. But what I would say is that
if you don't know who the sucker is, it might be you.
That's it. Yes.
This sounds kind of like a VPN for
money. Yeah.
For Bitcoin, for money.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it turns out that not only is Wasabi growth exploding, but in August of 2019, 1 month before sanctioned countries started to either make announcements or leak that they were setting up crypto infrastructure, the amount of Wasabi transactions exploded. I mean, the bar graph makes no sense, right? So first of all, it's growing exponentially, right? There's a hockey stick growth of Wasabi Youth. There's some variability, but in August of 2019, there's a 250% increase. Now, I'm not saying these things are connected, but Occam's razor would lead you to raise an eyebrow and at a minimum start looking into it. And so that's what we started to do. We're like, wow, this is ridiculous growth. How do we try to connect the dots here between, you know, what we think might be happening, which is a huge amount of Bitcoin being made fungible and all of this crypto infrastructure being announced and, you know, this Bitcoin thing being super dominant and growing its dominance on the darknet. And so I'm looking for any leads that anybody listening to this can give us to help us actually connect these dots. You know, we are in talks with services like Dark Owl. They're just a little expensive. I think it's like $60,000 per seat per year. If there's any reporters, if there's any Onion addresses that you can share that we can go to, we're looking to try to understand if our thesis is correct. If governments of any size, whether they're sanctioned or unsanctioned, are proactively using a crypto to influence the events inside of a country. And then further, if they are, which crypto are they using? And then the last step is, can we follow that trail, those breadcrumbs, to find if crypto is being hoarded proactively by those people? So we're looking for hard evidence. Right now, we have signals, but it's not a straight line. And that's what we're looking for.
This all sounds quite interesting. So I know that there's been some concerns from some exchanges about them essentially blocking Wasabi wallet access to their exchanges. Can you speak to maybe the effect that the new way in which Wasabi is doing business will affect these exchanges both in the U.S. and abroad, and whether that will have any impact into what you are predicting will happen with crypto in the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah. So first of all, I think we need to take a step back and just look at the origin story of the guy who started Wasabi. He's an engineer. He just wanted to solve problems. And he was looking for a problem to solve. He didn't know what he was going to look for. And, you know, applied cryptography, if you like math and code, is pretty cool. And that's what crypto is. It's math applied to money. So he stumbles onto applied cryptography and he's like, whoa, this is cool, but, you know, like, doesn't really make sense because it's not private. And he looked around and he found one of the very early, you could call them co-founders of Bitcoin. It's not Satoshi, but it's Satoshi plus one. One of these guys made a proposal called CoinJoin, and nobody had really built CoinJoin yet. You know, some of the early Bitcoin guys basically said, hey, we'll give a prize to whoever can implement this decently well first. And he was like, I like money. I think I can implement this. And he wanted to make something that was useful. So, you know, just intellectually, he moved forward and he ended up making really the first usable version of CoinJoin. There was this other thing called Join Market, but the adoption's not there. And the network effect is so strong, right? The more users you have, the more useful it is. And, you know, there've been other folks like Samurai Wallet who've tried to do this, but again, the network effect is just so dominant with Wasabi. And so, you know, this guy kind of like didn't realize that he was going to be drinking from a fire hose, because as soon as he turned this thing on, holy moly, wow, like you cannot understand like how much growth he's experiencing. When you make a thing, almost like in almost no cases does that thing get used by anyone other than your mom. Like as a person who has made technology for a living for years, like it's really hard to get adoption. And the first real thing this guy ever made and put out into the wild to be used was an explosive success. So this guy is like hanging on for dear life to a rocket ship. He doesn't know what to do. He's like, help. And a couple of lawyers are looking at him like, I don't know what the heck is going on, but we'll try to help you. So he ends up getting these two co-founders that are lawyers. And they're like, oh my God, we don't know what's going on either. Let's try to make sure we're not breaking any laws. So, you know, they're basically a guy who's trying to solve problems and two lawyers trying to make sure that they're not upsetting any of the men with guns. And they're all holding on to this rocket ship. Now, there are lots of competing interests in the world of internet money. You know, on the other side of the table, you have groups like Chainalysis who have raised enormous piles of money to try to sell tools to regulators. So they have their own interests, and, you know, respect to everybody out there who's trying to make a dollar. I'm not looking to, put them down in any way, shape, or form. But I will say that they have a strong interest in selling regulators, whatever the regulator's hair on fire problem is, right? And so it is conceivable that these folks over at Chainalysis are seeing what's happening with Wasabi. They're realizing there is no way for them to use the tools that they are selling to regulators to track this stuff in a way that they've previously said was possible. And they're, you know, basically saying, we gotta like just attack this larger entity that's hurting our business. And so it is conceivable to me that that is the conversation that they're having with regulators. Now, on the other side, Wasabi has made one massive change to the way they do business, which is really sad for me because I am no longer able to reverse engineer their data. It's a sad day because I love that data. That data was fascinating. They stopped using the same coordinator address for several months at a time. And instead, every single CoinJoin, and there's several that happen a day, uses a fresh coordinator address.
And I think they call it the Cedric fix.
You know, it wouldn't surprise me if they called it that internally, because I talk to those guys as often as I can, because I'm obsessed with what they're doing. I think it's the leading indicator of dark net adoption of Bitcoin was watching their service explode, because no vendor in their right mind who has any sense of operational security would use Bitcoin any other way than to use Wasabi's CoinJoin. That would be it. And you know, some of these vendors are countries, by the way. So like, let's be careful about calling them criminals, because you might be calling a country a criminal and you might be calling your own country a criminal. So we should be really careful about calling.
I have before. And I will again.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. Fair enough. I will not say anything either way. I'd like to stay impartial. But the thing is, like, when you look at these groups, like Chainalysis, again, respect to all the people who are out there trying to make a dollar, I get it. Wasabi is moving extremely quickly at becoming untraceable. And it's not just that Wasabi is moving quickly, it's that they are aggressively pursuing ways to make it impossible for anyone, whether you're a well-intentioned regulator, a curious researcher, or a bad-intentioned hacker, they're making it impossible for anyone to follow the breadcrumbs. And so I have a hard time believing that Chainalysis or anybody else, including me or my group, is going to be able to figure out what Wasabi wallets are and aren't mixing transactions. If you're like talking to the founder of Wasabi, if you're talking to that team, you realize they're just moving way too fast on the offense for a defense to catch up. If you study the history.
Yeah, usually it's like a cat and mouse game, right? Yeah.
It is.
The one moves and the other one catches up to them. And
yeah.
That's a great way to put it. So that way, yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, you read my mind. So in the history of technology, one of the largest asymmetric drivers of technology, and this is really underappreciated, is war, right? And in war, you have you see a mouse and you want that mouse. You want, like, you see treasure, you want that treasure. So the offensive team makes some weapon that they believe will allow them to get the mouse. And, you know, the mouse, the defensive position, tries to create some defense that, like, blocks it. But there's a gap in time there, right? And what's happening is that as technology accelerates, it is becoming easier for offense to come up with innovations than it is for defenders to catch up. And so in the world of privacy, however you see it, fortunately, unfortunately, it is very likely in the privacy development's favor versus people who are trying to track this stuff and prevent them. So while Chainalysis may have been able to do this in the past, I find it extremely unlikely that they will be able to do it in the future, because my team is just as good.
The article always mentioning about Chainalysis being able to go back and pierce the veil of anonymity. So does this mean that I guess Bitcoin goes back to it being the dream of having that anonymized, independent world currency, that it was kind of like the early dream, or does it mean something else?
I think that I don't have any association with any, like, you know, libertarian or any specific worldview, but it does look like we're at the very early stages of the game theory that I laid out, which is that the most disadvantaged countries seem to be adopting crypto. The dominant crypto of the darknet is Bitcoin. It would follow, I would assume, that they are asymmetrically hoarding Bitcoin in order to pay contractors, in order to function, in case different sanctions get put against them proactively. And as we watch events play out, you know, like the trade war with US and China, you have to be imagining that these disadvantaged countries want, like, the more disadvantaged you are, the more you want fair money. And this kind of is leading to that question you asked earlier about the Chinese digital currency, which is that there is a power asymmetry in that currency, which is held by the Chinese. And so the most disadvantaged countries actually want the fairest money. And the most advantaged countries don't want that. They want to retain their power asymmetry. And so I do not believe that a asymmetric power crypto or coin or digital currency, whatever you want to call it, I think the incentive is smaller to hoard that proactively versus hoarding money that is fairer and being used dominantly. Because those two things are in the favor of Bitcoin at the moment, it appears to me that Bitcoin is like definitely in the lead position to become the head of the long tail of what eventually plays out.
Oh, so there's no need to, so kind of like what you were saying earlier, I thought there would be something like a new cryptocurrency that would be tailor-made, purpose-made for privacy or avoid some of the traceability problems, or if you see it as a problem that Bitcoin had. But you're saying with this new technology and, you know, the first mover and the use on the dark web and other places, that Bitcoin does kind of like make a big breakthrough and becomes what? More of does get to that world currency kind of status?
I thought the same thing that you thought. So there was a breakthrough not too long ago in applied cryptography called Mimblewimble. This thing, it's faster, it's better, it's more private. It's like, it's so much better from an engineering point of view. It's way more private. It avoids all sorts of problems that Bitcoin has. It even gives you some smart contract-y things that, you know, Bitcoin doesn't have. It kind of gives you some of the powers of Ethereum, like a smart contract, but also, you know, like the powers of Monero, you know, with a lot of privacy, but it avoids the problems of Monero. I was expecting this to be the new thing. I thought it was going to be Monero, Zcash, Dash, and then the Mimblewimble implementations, you know, which are...
I like Tron myself, but...
Okay, sure. Whatever it might be. I don't know if you're joking there. But the thing is that none of those things were actually being used. And I think it all comes down to the user network effect was just there for Bitcoin. It was just there and it was good enough. And the privacy tools, they got better fast enough that, you know, it sort of like hit this dominance place. And I think it's actually super dominant today, meaning it is either at or approaching the place where second place, it just is, it's impossible for them to catch up.
Like you're saying, the network effect is just too strong.
I think we're approaching that inflection point. I don't think we're there yet. And like, this is the reason that I think we're still early, is anything before that inflection point, in my opinion, is early. Anything after that inflection point is late. And so in my opinion, we're still early.
There's still time, yeah. Yeah, interesting. So, you know, we have a lot of users who maybe dabble in cryptocurrency, some who do some trading. Can you even share any sort of advice or anything for sort of the retail user to keep in mind as this market keeps evolving and changing and possibly getting to that inflection point that you mentioned?
Absolutely. Don't day trade. That's my number one advice is don't day trade. And I'll tell you why. When I started an early US regulated Bitcoin exchange with backing from Google Ventures and Y Combinator, et cetera, you know, we had to make the markets. We had to make sure there was always a buyer and always a seller. And so we spun up what might have been the first crypto hedge fund just to make the markets. So we raised some money in Bitcoin. And the idea was we would always be trading back and forth and we'd give our investors back more Bitcoin than they gave us. Luckily, we were able to do that. But in doing so, I had to hire a Wall Street algo trader. And in doing so, I learned, wow, these algo traders, they are way better than a human. You know, a bot that is well-trained and well-observed and, you know, like has a team of people obsessively nurturing it and teaching it, is going to do way better than any day trader. These algo bots don't need to sleep. They can avoid a lot of the biases that humans have. It's just very unlikely that a human day trader is going to be able to outperform these algo bots, these professional hedge fund traders who are, you know, hunting for alpha, who are looking to, you know, really like steal your lunch money. Because in the short term, when you're day trading, you're trying to basically take money from someone who is less educated than you. Because the current price, it's a lagging indicator. It shows you the expected future value of all the market participants inside of the market. So if you're day trading, it's just so hard to get any kind of exotic information that could give you a material advantage that some professional investor doesn't have. So retail, you're just like, you are lunch if you're day trading. And nobody wants to be lunch, you know?
Yeah, you're just trading on more like longer term, some fundamental changes that you see going on and placing like a more broader bet, not on a specific timing, but on, because you don't know exactly when it'll happen, right?
Right. So my only advice would be don't day trade. Now, what I'm about to say is not advice. This is my thesis. I would like to give you my thesis for free and encourage you to disagree with me. My group builds tools.
We're going to charge for it, but go ahead.
My group builds tools that help me monitor the progress of this. But, you know, the idea, it's not a really like exotic idea. And the basic idea is all of the most successful tech investors in history have made their bets based on three things. Solve a problem, a hair on fire problem, for a large market, and make sure that that technology captures value. So like email, huge amounts of value provided, zero value capture. TCP/IP, the backbone of the internet, huge value provider. Does it capture any value? Nope, not a single bit. And so Bitcoin is kind of like the first protocol ever that could capture value. So whatever it is that you believe can do these three things, like, you know, come to your own conclusions. I would encourage you to study people like Paul Graham, Peter Thiel, et cetera. But if you find a technology that is solving some hair on fire problem, just track the user network effect. Don't pay attention to the stories. Don't listen to the crypto cults on Twitter. You know, don't even look at the developers per se. What you really want to look at, and, you know, we can come back to the developer network effect, which is important, but the most important one is there some group of users that are absolutely desperate for this thing? And then if that's the case, go there and just watch them as closely as you can. And what you're looking for are consistent growth rates. And the reason you're looking for that is you are looking for an inelastic market. Now, the interesting thing about the darknet, for example, is that the demand for black market goods, it is inelastic. It is at least always constant, regardless of how the economy performs, et cetera. Now, the wacky thing about the black market is it is defined as things that are illegal. Now, anybody who is paying attention to government and governance realizes that there's a phenomenon in government, which is that laws only grow. We don't have an expiry date on laws. And so the number of laws is unidirectionally growing, which, if you zoom out far enough, what that means is the black market is only growing along with these laws unidirectionally growing. And so, you know, it's really
but
nice.
The New York Times is illegal in China, so that would be a black market good. So
that's right. And, you know, that's a really interesting point, is that illegal really depends on where in the world you are and who you're talking to. Because, you know, for people to say that only criminals use the darknet, you know, they could be talking about a country that they like. They could be talking about a government that they like. And so we just have to be really careful about how we think about adoption. So, you know, what I would encourage people to do is study adoption in places that need the technology. And there's only one place, according to how we defined crypto at the beginning of this conversation, where crypto does something special, which is censorship resistance. And the only place where I know of where you can really study that is on the darknet. So but don't use the darknet, because you are probably going to end up on the menu. So just proceed very cautiously.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, that's really a different way to think about a lot of these things than I have before.
Great. So, this has been a really great conversation, Cedric. And I think that it's ultimately a matter of keeping abreast as to what governments are doing, the people with guns, looking at the users, looking at where the demand is, and also as a word of advice that I actually will second is do not day trade, because you are the lunch, you're on the menu.
Yeah, I think you nailed it.
Yeah, great. Yeah, really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for joining us on the podcast. Really look forward to see you in the news in some form.
Yeah. How can our listeners either get a hold of you or follow what you're doing online?
Yeah. So I lead research at the 1000X Group. And if you go to 1000x.report, 1000x.report, we have a video where we just give away information about how we do things. Our basic idea is like, look, we track all the things regarding adoption. We'll show you how to do them by yourself if you want, but we think we're all better off if we pool resources and get smarter together. So whether you're looking to learn more about what we do, to do it yourself, or you want to join our group and do it together, 1000x.report is the place. I'm also on Twitter, at Cedric Makes. If you disagree with anything I've said here, please tweet at me. Let me know where I might be wrong. And let's just all get smarter together.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Cedric.
Yeah, thank you.